Welcome to the latest edition of the Garnet Community Podcast. Before we begin, let me offer an apology that some of the sound quality isn't great in this recording. We were recording Cassia and Matthew from Dundee, and it seems that Dundee was underwater during the recording. So apologies for that, but I still hope you enjoy the content. On today's Garnet Community Podcast, we're talking about a paper just published in eLife, the title of which is Nanopore Direct RNA Sequencing Maps the Complexity of Arabidopsis mRNA Processing and Methylation Modification. So this is a really excellent paper with loads of great data and a huge amount of computational analysis in it. The paper's got four first authors, and we're joined by three of those authors today. So speaking to us from the University of Dundee is Matthew Parker and Cassia Knop, whilst speaking to us from Copenhagen, where she's moved to now, is Anya Sherwood. So thanks very much for joining us today. But the first question to ask is, can you explain how direct RNA sequencing differs from regular RNA sequencing?
Yeah, because you're sequencing the RNA directly, then there is only one strand, right? You don't have a double-stranded molecule. Mm-hmm. So, but the way that the RNA moves through the pore is that we have a poly-T adapter so that we capture the 3' end, mm-hmm. and then we sequence from the 3' end in a 3-5' direction. We always capture the true 3' end of the molecule and then make our way to the 5' end.
Okay, so this technique is particularly strong for looking at 3' ends. So I would imagine, just intuitively, you'd think, so normal RNA-seq, you have it fragmented all the way across the gene. But with this, you're going to get a lot of bias at the 3' end. So what prevents you just getting loads of 3' UTRs and the back end of genes? And how can you predict that you're going to get those transcriptional start points correctly?
We improved the regular library protocol by adding some extra steps prior library preparation. So we designed a special adapter that is ligated to only caps mRNAs. So by adding those special steps at the very beginning, we are sure that the mRNA that we are sequencing are full-length molecules. Okay. And to be honest, now when we have two protocols, I mean the regular library protocol and our cap-dependent protocol, you can use both of them. It depends what you are interested in. If you are interested in capturing only full-length mRNAs, then it's better to do this cap-dependent steps first and to ligate this adapter. But for example, if you are interested in identifying some processing products like microRNA cleavage products, is better to go with the regular protocol, because also in our paper we published that the nanopore has the potential to identify some cleavage products, like for example microRNA cleavage products.
Okay, cool. So the really cool biology in this is revolves around this methylation of messenger RNAs, and that's been something that the Simpson lab has been involved with over the past few years. So this is not a regular protocol to use for the nanopore, as I understand. So can you tell us a little bit about how you adapted the protocol in order to allow the nanopore to measure these methylated RNA residues?
To identify the methylation, we basically sequenced a methylation mutant viralizer and then a methylation viralizer complemented line where methylation was restored. And when you look at RNA sequencing from the mutant, you can see that the nanopore sequencer makes less errors because there is less M6A in the mutants, so it doesn't make an error reading through the M6A. So Matt came up with a computational analysis where we looked at the sites in viralizer mutant where there is less of these errors, so we can actually identify methylation in the RNA, but not just in RNA, but we can see the methylation in the full context of mRNA, meaning in the splicing context, the 3' UTR, the 3' end, and the 5' end of the RNA.
Essentially, yeah, we're working off the basis that the base is a machine learning model, and so because it's not trained to recognize M6A, it's going to make mistakes when it comes across it, and so by having the comparative approach with the methylation mutant, then that means that we can identify positions where there are more or less errors, basically.
I wanted to also add that this particular method is brilliant in the way that you don't just have to analyze M6A. If you're interested in a different RNA or DNA modification, you can take this way of analysis of looking at the mutant and the complemented line, and then you can actually identify where your favorite RNA or DNA modification is occurring in the transcriptome or genome.
The cool aspect of this is this computational work. So, Matt, I think you're mostly involved in this. Have you collaborated with Nanopore themselves to try and work on, you know, how you've developed this technology?
No, we don't. We haven't really collaborated with them, no.
Okay.
Yeah, Gordon's quite proud of the fact that we are evaluating their technology as a completely independent group. You know, we haven't really got any links with them at all.
So you measured differences in the methylation of the RNA. And what did you see? What differences are there in this VIRA1 mutant?
One of the really interesting things that we see to start with is that a lot of the transcripts that had methylation previously. Those genes seem to get downregulated in the virilizer mutant, and so we think maybe that M6A has a stabilizing effect on transcripts somehow, potentially at the post-translational level. We also saw defects in the circadian clock of the virilizer mutant, so they had a slightly longer period length than wild type and the complemented line plants. We're not quite sure what's causing that yet, but it's interesting to see some of the downstream effects of loss of M6A. Yeah, and then another really quite interesting effect that we saw is a link between M6A and 3' end processing.
Okay.
So in the virilizer mutant, we see that we get a switch to proximal polyadenylation in a lot of transcripts that previously had M6A. And at the moment, it's kind of just a theory, but what we think might be happening is that that M6A at proximal poly-A sites could potentially block usage of that site, so you get read-through of that poly-A signal, whereas in the mutant where the M6A is not present, suddenly that poly-A site can now be used.
And that would have some implications to the processing of the RNA in some way?
Yeah, so if you remove a part of the 3' UTR, that can remove regulatory elements that that could either stabilize or destabilize the transcripts. So microRNA target sites or other regulatory elements in the 3' UTR, yeah.
I see. So, right, so just as a final question, and a kind of more general question maybe to Anya, you know, what can this technique do for improving, like, annotation of genomes in general, not just Arabidopsis, but all plants or other, you know, other organisms?
Well, during the general analysis of this paper, we were able to see that the annotation of particularly 5' ends of the RNAs is not as well performed as it should be, and the Aeroport 11 tend to have longer the 5' UTRs, and the ones that we have seen using our techniques and other techniques that we have used also in the lab. We were also able to identify not new splicing sites per se, but a new combination of the already identified splicing site. So you can almost think of splicing as a puzzle. So you take exon 1, exon 3, and exon 5, splice it together, and you can clearly see this combination in using Nanopore versus the previous technology. Looking at these isoforms is fairly difficult computationally because it's not a direct thing. We were also able to see really nicely 3' ends, as you said. This is a very big string.
Okay, that's great. So as I usually say, I would urge people to take a look at this paper. It's really interesting. There's a lot of detail in there that we haven't touched on today. And just let me say thank you guys for contributing to the podcast today. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.